Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Word Origins, the podcast where we unlock the secrets of the English language, one fascinating word at a time. I'm Chris, your guide through the intriguing world of etymology.
And I'm Rachel, here to learn alongside all of you and perhaps throw in a question or two from a Chinese listener's perspective. We're so excited to have you join us for another session of discovery.
Absolutely, Rachel. Today, we're diving deep into the world of various practitioners, the professionals who help us with everything from our minds to our feet, and even our teeth. We'll explore what they do and, more importantly, where their professional titles come from, tracing them back to their ancient Greek and Latin roots.
Oh, this sounds like it's going to be super practical. We encounter these professionals in our daily lives, but I've never really stopped to think about the stories hidden in their job titles. I'm especially curious about those tricky ones that sound similar but do very different things.
That's a fantastic point, Rachel. And that's exactly what we'll uncover. You know, much like how an ancient Greek philosopher might have mused about the meaning of life, or a Roman engineer decided to build a road, every occupation has its own unique story, contributing its little mite to the progress of the world. We'll be exploring the ideas behind these people's occupations and the words that translate these ideas into verbal symbols.
That's a beautiful way to put it. So, where shall we start our journey, Chris? With the mind, perhaps?
Excellent suggestion, Rachel. Let's start with someone who is truly a student of human behavior. This practitioner is an expert in the dark mysteries of human behavior. What makes people act as they do, why they have certain feelings, and how their personalities were formed. They try to understand what makes us tick.
Sounds like a detective for the soul. In China, we might call them a Xanli Zexunsh. Xanli Zexunsh, a mental health counselor.
Precisely. And the English word for this professional is a psychologist. By education and training, they are equipped to work in industries, schools, or institutions, devising ways to keep workers productive, students well-adjusted, and even inmates contented. With a state license, they might also offer private or group therapy.
So, a psychologist studies the mind. Where does that word come from, Chris?
That's where the etymology becomes really insightful, Rachel. The word psychologist is built upon the same Greek root as psychiatrist. And that root is psyche, which means spirit, soul, or mind. In psychologist, this psyche combines with logos, meaning science or study. So, by its very etymology, a psychologist is literally one who studies the mind.
Logos, like in biology, the study of life, or geology, the study of the earth. That makes perfect sense. So, psychology is the field, and psychological is the adjective.
Exactly. And the word psyche itself is an English word, referring to the mental life, the spiritual or non-physical aspect of one's existence. We also have the adjective psychic, which refers to phenomena or qualities that cannot be explained in purely physical terms.
Like someone who claims to have a sixth sense or can read minds, like those characters in fantasy dramas we see, they are often called psychic.
That's right. Or, if a person's disturbance is emotional or mental, rather than physical, we can also describe it as psychic. Now, let's dig a little deeper into psyche. If you combine psyche with the Greek word pathos, meaning suffering or disease, you get psychopathic.
Psychopathic, that sounds quite serious, doesn't it?
It does, Rachel. Psychopathic describes someone suffering from a severe mental or emotional disorder. The noun for this condition is psychopathy. It's a powerful word that really emphasizes the suffering of the mind.
It's good to understand the origins, but I hope we don't encounter many psychopathic people in real life.
Indeed. Let's move to another interesting combination, psyche, with the Greek word soma, which means body. This gives us psychosomatic.
Psychosomatic? Does that mean when your mind affects your body? Like when you're really stressed about an exam and suddenly your stomach hurts, even though you're not physically ill?
You've hit the nail on the head, Rachel. That's a perfect example. Psychosomatic is an adjective that delineates the powerful influence that the mind, especially the unconscious mind, has on bodily diseases. The sources give an example of someone who fears a meeting and suddenly develops a bad cold, a backache, or even gets into a traffic accident.
Wait, so the person gets a real cold or a real backache or a real injury, but the cause is from their mind, their feelings? That's really profound.
It truly is. According to psychosomatic theory, their unconscious mind made them susceptible to the cold germs, caused the backache, or even led them into the path of the car, making their appearance at the meeting impossible. So, a psychosomatic disorder actually exists in terms of its symptoms: headaches, excessive urination, pains, paralysis, heart palpitations. But there is no organic cause within the body. The cause is within the psyche, the mind.
Wow, that's quite a concept. So our thoughts and emotions can really have a direct impact on our physical health. It reminds me of the traditional Chinese medicine concept of Xin Shen He Yi, Xen Shen He Y, which emphasizes the unity of mind and body. It's comforting to see similar ideas across cultures, even if the explanations differ.
That's a wonderful connection, Rachel. It highlights the universal truth that our inner world profoundly affects our outer experience. Now, let's talk about another practitioner who delves into the unconscious mind, a psychoanalyst. This is someone who follows the techniques devised by Sigmund Freud.
Ah, Sigmund Freud. I've heard his name before, even in China. He's a very famous historical figure in psychology.
Indeed, he is. A psychoanalyst is a physician, psychiatrist, or psychologist specially trained in the techniques developed by Sigmund Freud. Their approach encourages you to delve into that part of your mind called the unconscious. By reviewing your early experiences, traumas, feelings, and thoughts, you can come to a better understanding of your present worries, fears, conflicts, repressions, insecurities, and nervous tensions. This understanding is the first step in coping with them.
So it's like digging into a very old, forgotten storage room in your mind to find out why things are the way they are now. What does the treatment involve?
The treatment primarily involves the practitioner listening to you and helping you interpret the meaning of your free-flowing ideas. These sessions are usually frequent and can often go on for a year or more. The aim of psychoanalysis is to guide the patient to an awareness of the deep-seated, unconscious causes of anxieties, fears, conflicts, and tension. The psychoanalysts claim that once these causes are found, exposed to the light of day, and thoroughly understood, they may vanish, much like light snow melting under strong sunlight.
That's a vivid image. So, the goal is to bring what's hidden in the unconscious to the conscious mind and deal with it. The sources give an example of someone with asthma that has no physical basis. How would psychoanalysis help there?
It's a fascinating example. Let's say your doctor finds no physical reason for your asthma and refers you to a psychoanalyst, or a psychiatrist or clinical psychologist trained in psychoanalytically oriented therapy. In your sessions, you might explore your past life and discover, for instance, that your parents always set impossibly high goals for you. No matter what you achieved in school, it was never enough in their eyes.
Oh, I can relate to that pressure. Many Chinese children face immense academic expectations from their parents. It's a common experience.
Absolutely, Rachel. That's a perfect cultural parallel. The sources suggest that as a child, you might have built up resentments and anxieties because you felt unable to please your parent. And this might sound far-fetched, but it's perfectly possible as a result, you could have become asthmatic. The unconscious might have developed this symptom as a way to get the parental love, approbation, or attention you felt you weren't receiving.
So, the asthma could have been an unconscious plea for attention or a way to escape pressure. That's truly eye-opening. And if the asthma is emotionally, rather than organically, based, what happens then?
If your ailment is indeed psychogenic, meaning of psychic origin, built on psyche plus Greek genesis, meaning birth or origin, or psychosomatic, which results from the interaction of mind and body, therapy can be very effective.
So psychogenic and psychosomatic are closely related terms, often used interchangeably, even though they have slight differences in definition.
Precisely. and the treatment for such disorders isn't drugs or surgery, because those help the body, not the emotions. Instead, you work out, in psychoanalytic parlance, early traumas through talk, remembering, exploring, interpreting, and reliving childhood experiences. If the asthma is psychogenic or psychosomatic, therapy will very likely help, and the attacks may cease, either gradually or suddenly.
That's a powerful thought, that talking through our past can physically heal us. It's a profound understanding of human resilience.
It is. However, it's worth noting that Freudian therapy, while foundational, is less popular today. Many newer therapies, such as Gestalt, bioenergetics, and transactional analysis, claim to produce quicker results. In any case, psychotherapy of one sort or another is the indicated treatment for psychogenic or psychosomatic disorders, or for any personality disturbances.
And the person who practices psychotherapy is called a psychotherapist, or therapist for short. The adjective is psychotherapeutic, so it all circles back to the psyche, the mind, and healing.
It certainly does, Rachel. That's a good chunk on the mind. Shall we move from the mind to something a bit more tangible, like teeth?
From the spiritual to the structural. Yes, let's chew on that for a bit. What kind of practitioner straightens teeth?
That would be an orthodontist. This practitioner is a dentist who has taken postgraduate work specifically in the straightening of teeth.
I remember having braces when I was younger, so I know orthodontists very well. My parents always emphasized having a good smile. So, what's the word origin here?
The word orthodontist is built on two Greek roots, orthos, meaning straight or correct, and odontos, meaning tooth. So, an orthodontist is literally someone who straightens teeth.
Orthos, like in orthodox, meaning correct belief. I see the connection. So, straight tooth specialist.
Exactly. And once you know odontos means tooth, you can unlock a whole family of dental specialists. For example, a pedodontist. Can you guess what they might specialize in? The root paidos means child.
Paidos, like in pediatrician for children's doctors. So a pedodontist must specialize in the care of children's teeth. That makes so much sense. And the specialty would be pedodontia and the adjective pedodontic.
You got it. And how about a periodontist? This term combines odontos with the prefix peri, meaning around or surrounding.
Peri around, odontos tooth. So a periodontist deals with what's around the tooth? The gums. Like perimeter is the distance around something. So they're a gum specialist. The specialty must be periodontia and the adjective periodontal.
Excellent deductions, Rachel. You're mastering these roots. Now, for an endodontist, the prefix here is endo, from Greek endon, meaning inner or within.
Endo, inner or within, odontos, tooth. So, an endodontist specializes in the inner part of the tooth? Like root canal therapy, where they work on the pulp inside the tooth. That's a very specific specialty. So the specialty is endodontia, and the adjective is endodontic.
Spot on. And finally, if ex means out, what do you suppose an exodontist specializes in?
Ex, out, odontos, tooth. An exodontist must specialize in taking teeth out, like pulling teeth. I'm guessing the specialty is exodontia, and the adjective is exodontic. That was fun. So many different dental specialists all stemming from odontos.
Isn't it fascinating how just one root word can help us understand so many different professions? It's like unlocking a secret code. Now, let's shift our focus from teeth to eyes. We have a practitioner who measures vision. Who is that, Rachel?
That would be an optometrist. They measure your vision and prescribe the type of glasses that will give you a new and more accurate view of the world.
Exactly. And the etymology of optometrist is also very clear. It's built on opsis or opticos, meaning view or vision, plus metron, meaning measurement. So, an optometrist, by etymology, literally measures vision.
Metron. Measurement. That's a root I recognize from other words.
Indeed. Metron is the root in many familiar words. For example, a thermometer. Thermi is Greek for heat, so a thermometer is an instrument to measure heat.
Like when you have a fever, you use a thermometer to measure your body temperature, very common in China.
Or a barometer, which combines baros, Greek for weight, with metron. So, a barometer measures atmospheric pressure. The adjective is barometric.
I see, for understanding weather patterns.
And a more complex one, a sphygmomanometer. This is a device for measuring blood pressure, combining sphygmos, Greek for pulse, with manometer, which itself comes from metron.
Wow, that's a mouthful. But knowing metron helps break it down, and of course the metric system itself, which is a decimal system of weights and measures. That's very familiar to us in China, as we use it every day.
Yes, the metric system is a perfect example of metron in action, and very globally recognized. From measuring vision, let's move on to those who work with bones and the body. We have a practitioner who uses manipulation and massage as curative techniques.
Who would that be?
This practitioner is an osteopath. The profession originated in 1874 when Andrew T. still devised a drugless technique of curing diseases by massage and other manipulative procedures. This technique was based on the theory that illness might be caused by the undue pressure of displaced bones on nerves and blood vessels.
So they focus on how the bones and muscles affect the body's overall health, often without medication. Their training must be quite rigorous.
It is. Their training is equal to that of physicians, and in most states, they may use the same methods and have the full rights and privileges of medical doctors. Now, for the etymology, osteopath combines Greek osteon, meaning bone, with pathos, meaning suffering or disease.
Osteon for bone, like osteoporosis, which is a bone disease. So an osteopath, by etymology, means someone who deals with bone suffering or disease.
That's a good observation, Rachel. However, here's an important nuance. Despite the misleading etymology, an osteopathic physician is not a bone specialist. They shouldn't be confused with an orthopedist, who is a bone specialist. An osteopath has a broader, holistic approach to healing, often involving manipulation.
That's a crucial distinction. The etymology can sometimes be a bit of a red herring if you don't look closer at the actual practice. Good to know.
Indeed. And speaking of manipulation, there's another practitioner who also uses hands-on techniques, especially focused on the spinal column. They are licensed and legally recognized in many places and pursue academic studies and training similar to other major healing professions. Their basic principle is maintaining the structural and functional integrity of the nervous system.
I think I know who you're talking about. Is it a chiropractor? My friends in China who experience back pain sometimes seek out chiropractors for adjustments.
You are absolutely right. It's a chiropractor. Their treatment consists of manipulating most of the articulations of the body, especially those connected to the spinal column. And their name also comes from Greek roots. Chiro comes from chir, meaning hand, and praktikos means practical or effective. So, a chiropractor literally heals with their hands.
Heals with hands. That's very descriptive and accurate. The specialty is chiropractic. What other words use chir or chiro?
Well, chir combines with grapheme, meaning to write, to form chirography. Given what we learned about graphologists, what do you think chirography is?
Chiro, hand. Graphy, writing. So chirography must be writing by hand, or penmanship. That makes perfect sense.
Precisely. And an expert in beautiful handwriting would be a chirographer. And the adjective is chirographic. Though the sources note that chirography may be a lost art in these days of electronic word processing.
It's true. It's a shame, though. Chinese calligraphy, shufa, is a highly respected art form, and many people still practice it today. It's not just writing, it's an expression of beauty and skill.
That's an excellent parallel, Rachel. It makes the concept of chirography and the importance of handwriting much more relatable. Now, here's a fun one. If the suffix mansi comes from a Greek word meaning foretelling or prediction, What would chiromancy be?
Chiro hand, mancy prediction. So chiromancy must be foretelling the future by reading hands, like palmistry. I've seen that in movies.
You're absolutely right. It's the art of palm reading. And the person who practices chiromancy is a chiromancer, with the adjective being chiromantic. So, from doctors to fortune tellers, all using their hands.
That's quite a range. Speaking of hands and feet, what about the practitioner who treats minor ailments of the feet?
That would be a podiatrist. This practitioner treats minor foot ailments like corns, calluses, bunions, and fallen arches, and may even perform minor surgery.
I sometimes get calluses from walking too much or wearing uncomfortable shoes. So, a podiatrist is a foot doctor. What's the origin of that word?
The word podiatrist comes from Greek paus, or podos, meaning foot, combined with iatreia, meaning medical healing. So, a podiatrist practices podiatry, and the adjective is podiatric.
Paus, or podos, for foot. That's a very useful root.
It is, and you'll find it in many other words. For example, an octopus. Octo is Greek for eight. So, an octopus is literally an eight-footed sea creature, though we usually say eight-armed.
That's a great image. Octopuses are fascinating creatures, very popular in aquariums.
Then there's the platypus, that strange water mammal with a duck's bill and webbed feet. Plates means broad or flat in Greek, so by etymology, a platypus is a flat foot.
A flat foot? That's quite funny for such a unique animal.
We also have podium, which is a speaker's platform. Etymologically, it's a place for the feet. The suffix ium often signifies place where, like in gymnasium or stadium.
Oh, like a stage where a speaker stands. That makes sense.
And a tripod for a camera or other device. Tri means three, so a tripod is a three-legged or three-footed stand.
So many common words all coming back to foot.
And here's an interesting historical note. An earlier title for a podiatrist, still often used, is chiropodist.
Chiropodist? Chiro for hand, podos for foot. So, literally, hand-foot specialist. Why would they be called that?
That's a great question. The term chiropody was coined in the days before labor-saving machinery and push-button devices, when people often worked with their hands and developed calluses on their upper extremities, as well as on their feet. So, it acknowledged both aspects. Today, most of us have more sedentary occupations, so we might develop calluses on less visible parts of our anatomy.
That's a fascinating bit of social history embedded in a word. It reflects a different era of physical labor.
It truly does. Now, shifting back to the broader concept of writing, we touched on chirography earlier. Let's expand on the Greek verb grapheme, which means to write. It's the source of a great many English words.
We already know graphologist analyzes handwriting, from graphane and logos, meaning science or study. So graphology is the specialty, and graphological is the adjective.
Excellent recall, Rachel. And we also connected chirography, handwriting, with Chinese calligraphy. The word calligraphy itself, meaning penmanship as an artistic expression, is enjoying a revival. For centuries before printing, it was practiced by monks.
Calligraphy, shufa, is indeed beautiful writing.
And that's exactly what it means etymologically. Calligraphy combines graphine with Greek kalos, meaning beauty. So it literally means beautiful writing. A calligrapher designs and writes elegant announcements or place cards, and the adjective is calligraphic.
That's wonderful. So if there's a word for beautiful handwriting, is there one for the opposite? Bad, scrawly, or illegible handwriting?
There absolutely is. It's kakography. It combines graphine with Greek kakos, meaning bad or harsh.
Kakos, like in cacophony, meaning a harsh or unpleasant sound. So kakography means bad writing. So someone who uses bad handwriting would be a kakographer, and anything pertaining to bad handwriting would be kakographic.
Perfect. You're building your vocabulary with these roots. Grapheme is also found in many other English words you might know. For instance, a cardiograph. Cardia means heart, so it's etymologically a heart writer.
Oh, like an ECG machine that records heart activity.
Then there's photograph. Photos is Greek for light, so it's written by light. A beautiful description of how photos are created.
That's so poetic.
And a phonograph. Phone is Greek for sound, so it's a sound writer.
Like an old record player, capturing sound.
A telegraph. Tele means distance, so it's a distance writer. Sending messages across long distances.
Yes, very common in historical dramas.
And finally, a biography. Bios is Greek for life, so it's life writing, the story of a person's life.
Graphein is truly a prolific root. So many words we use every day have this hidden meaning of writing within them.
It truly is, Rachel. It's amazing how these ancient roots continue to shape our modern language. Now, let's talk about a topic that affects everyone eventually. Aging. We have a social scientist who deals with the problems of aging.
Getting old is a universal experience. In China, we have a strong tradition of respecting our elders, Zun Lao Ai Yu. So this sounds like a very important field.
It is, and the practitioner is a gerontologist. This social scientist deals with the financial, economic, sexual, social, retirement, and other non-medical problems of the elderly.
So, not a medical doctor for the elderly, but someone who looks at the broader social aspects of aging.
Exactly. A medical doctor specializing in the care of the elderly would be a geriatrician, but a gerontologist focuses on the broader societal and individual challenges of growing old. The Greek word for old age is geros, which has a derived form, geron, meaning old man. This geron is the root in gerontologist.
So, a gerontologist is a student of old men or students of old age. The specialty is gerontology, and the adjective is gerontological. That's very clear.
And complementing geron is another important root for old, this time from Latin. The Latin word for old is senex. This base gives us words like senile, senescent, senior, and senate.
Senex for old. Let's break these down.
First, senile. This describes someone showing signs of the physical and or mental deterioration that generally marks very old age. The noun is senility.
Unfortunately, that's a sad aspect of aging for some, a loss of cognitive function.
It is, and it's important to understand the clinical meaning of the word. Next, senescent. This means aging or growing old. You might notice the same suffix in words like adolescent, which means growing into an adult, or convalescent, meaning growing healthy again, or obsolescent, meaning growing or becoming obsolete.
So, senescent is a more general term for the process of aging, and the noun is senescence.
Precisely. Then we have senior, which simply means older. We use it for older people, or for students in their final year of high school or college, or even in job titles to indicate a higher rank. The noun is seniority.
Yes, like senior citizen or senior manager. It denotes experience and age.
And finally, senate. What comes to mind when you hear that word, Rachel?
A governing body, a council, often with a lot of experienced people.
That's exactly right. Historically, a senate was originally a council of older and presumably wiser citizens. So, the very name of that legislative body reflects the idea of age bringing wisdom and experience.
That's a beautiful thought, Chris. It connects the idea of old, not just with physical aging, but with accumulated knowledge and wisdom.
It really does, Rachel. And that brings us to the end of our exploration today. We've journeyed through the minds of psychologists, the skilled hands of orthodontists and chiropractors, the keen eyes of optometrists, the careful touch of podiatrists, the artistic flourish of calligraphers, and the profound wisdom of gerontologists, all through the lens of etymology.
It's truly amazing how much history and meaning are packed into the words we use every day. Understanding these origins has not only expanded my English vocabulary, but also given me a deeper appreciation for these professions and the human experience they represent. Thank you, Chris, for another enlightening session.
My pleasure, Rachel. And thank you, our listeners, for joining us on this linguistic adventure. We hope you've enjoyed uncovering the hidden stories behind these words as much as we have.
Don't forget to practice using these new words and keep an eye out for those Greek and Latin roots in your daily reading. They're everywhere once you know what to look for.
Indeed. Until next time, keep exploring, keep learning, and keep mastering words.
Bye for now.
Goodbye.